The history of prices tells us much about the history of other things: crime, war, social disarray, or stability. So says historian David Hackett Fisher, who writes in a new book about four price revolutions that marked the past 800 years of Western history. They occurred in medieval times, in the 16th century, in the 18th century, and in the 20th. In between those revolutions, periods of many decades in which prices steadily rose, there have been times of equilibrium. Times of rising prices lead to crisis, none worse than the 14th century, a time of famine, plague, decreasing population, and widespread pessimism. Times of equilibrium are conducive to relative peace, confidence, and optimism. David Hackett Fisher documents his history of prices with charts and graphs that illustrate these great movements over the course of history.
I'd stress that these are waves. One of my colleagues said that everybody's idea of history comes down to the circle or the line. These are not circles. They are separate events, each with its own history. And through these events, there is a kind of line, that is, each wave succeeds another.
You quote Mark Twain approvingly on his notion of history repeating itself.
Yes, Mark Twain said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It rhymes.
And there is a very nice rhyme scheme in this.
Well, what is it that happens in a great price revolution that might be similar if the price revolution was in medieval times or if it was in our own times?
Well, I think what happens in every case is people make choices, and choices make a difference. They decide to have more children when conditions are good. In a period of equilibrium, the world seems a better place to have children, and so population begins to grow. And when that happens, prices go up, mainly prices of necessities, food, fuel, always lead to the increase. Manufacturers lag behind. And for a while, people aren't aware of this as a new trend. They see it as a kind of price flutter. They're conscious of the event, but not of the context. And then at a certain point, the prices go beyond the fluctuations that had preceded it. And people discover that they are living in a great inflation. In the Middle Ages, they changed their language when that happened. They called it fames, famine, or a shortage of food. Then when they discover this trend, they call it charistia, dearness, a rise in the cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they do that, they begin to make other choices. They begin to do things about rising prices that make them rise farther.
For example, what do we do?
Well, they expand the money supply. If they are in a position to control the land, they raise the rent. If they have money to lend, they charge more interest.
I mean, everybody sees that prices are going up. Therefore, everybody needs more money to buy things that are more expensive. So they start doing all of these things, which will obviously make the problem worse.
That's right. And what's rational for an individual actor becomes irrational for the economy as a whole. And so things begin to get out of hand. The prices begin to fluctuate, and people are closer to the edge. When they get closer to the edge, we begin to get volatility in the early price revolutions.
And therefore, in price revolutions, you would say we begin to see, for example, rising crime rates.
Some of the most striking patterns I found are surges in crime that are the statistical shadow of surging prices. The two trends could not be closer. This has gone on in every price revolution, even in our own time. Now that prices are coming down a little bit, crime rates are falling. Many politicians take personal credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
They might as well take credit for the rising and falling of the tides in New York Harbor.
If the first half of the 14th century, let's say, was about the worst time and witnessed the worst terrible conditions people have seen in this 800-year period, what's the best? What's the best equilibrium that we've seen in all this
Well,
time?
I think the later periods of most of the equilibria were times, for most people, not all, of improvement. The Victorian era as a case in point. These were times of equilibrium, not of stasis. There were moments of stress even then. But by and large, these were better times. And people began to think of their condition in different ways. The philosophies, the literature, took on a different tone, described a world as a place of balance and proportion. And that mood continued into the early years of a price revolution, when people were very comfortable, even cocky in a way, about their cosmic fate. But then the trouble began. It often rose, I think, out of the hubris of that earlier period and the stresses began to develop. The families came under strain.
I'd like to ask you a question about writing history and about different ways of writing history. When you were last here, you'd written a book about Paul Revere's ride, a wonderful book about Paul Revere's ride. And that was about one single event and the social circumstances that surrounded it. This book is about a great broad theory of the sweep of history in many places over many centuries. What do you say to the historians, each of whom has written a book, as you did about Paul Revere's ride, each one wrote it about the decline of grain prices in France in the whatever century, and say, no, you can't generalize this broadly about what history is all about?
Well, I find that my colleagues who will often say, you can't generalize this broadly, will then go on to say, but generally speaking, I think that history is the most eclectic of disciplines. Historians do many different things, and we differ in our epistemology. A lot of historians tell stories. That's what I've done in some of my work. Other historians are like Herodotus. History for them is inquiry. It's solving problems, answering questions. Sometimes it's a matter of getting into the detail of ordinary experience of a single act. Others to try to find the context. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, I'm in my work, whether I'm working on this large scale or on a smaller one, I'm conscious of contingencies in history, of people making choices, of the choices shaping the events that followed, not always as we'd wish. And I would see these wave-like movements as flowing from processes of choice, just as Paul Revere's ride had done.
Well, David Hackett Fisher, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Historian David Hackett Fisher is author of The Great Wave, Price Revolutions, and The Rhythm of History.